Congress, the President of the United States.
Before President Trump even uttered a word last night, Republican members of Congress broke into a chant of four more years. The president opened his 2020 reelection bid on the biggest stage possible last night with an audience of millions who probably don't regularly pay attention to every rally or to every tweet. So what is the political lay of the land now that the 2020 campaign has begun in earnest, post-impeachment, post-Iowa, post-State of the Union? We're going to talk about that now with Peter Nicholas. He covers the White House for The Atlantic. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you. The headline of your story today, the State of the Union was an elaborate troll. What did you mean by that?
Well, these addresses are normally unifying kinds of civic virtues in some ways. Presidents have used the State of the Union address to try to unify the nation, bring people together to issue messages about the nation's purpose, national renewal, things like that. That's not what President Trump was doing with his State of the Union speech last night. What we saw from him was really the starting gun for his reelection campaign. He used the address to criticize Democrats sitting in front of him on the House floor who had embraced what he said were socialist ideas involving health care, who were embracing plans that would potentially bankrupt the country that they were so expensive. He was critical of his predecessor, Barack Obama, talked about how Obama's economic record was really poor. So in a sense, it was mischievous. It was a troll. It was dressed up as a State of the Union speech, but in fact, it was a very partisan message.
Okay, let's hear that bite you talked about health care.
132 lawmakers in this room have endorsed legislation to impose a socialist takeover of our health care system, wiping out the private health insurance plans of 180 million very happy Americans. To those watching at home tonight, I want you to know we will never let socialism destroy American health care.
So who was he talking about there by not mentioning their names? Was it Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren or the entire Democratic presidential field?
I think he's talking about the Democratic presidential field, and I think he's also talking about a liberal faction inside the Democratic caucus in Congress. And look, the tone was set very early on when Nancy Pelosi tried to shake his hand when she was handed his speech, and he refused to take it. He turned away. Mm-hmm. And she concluded by tearing up his address. And I think that that's where we are at this stage in our politics, where the civility that normally reigned during State of the Union addresses has been abandoned. It's just fiercely partisan, and that's what we saw for an hour and 20 minutes last night.
Although he did try to extend some kind of, I don't know if it's an olive branch, but some kind of appeal to more moderate TV watchers, right, with some of the various things that he talked about saying that he has increased employment among African Americans and Hispanics and various other proposals. He talked about planting millions of trees to be a better environmental steward. So is he really trying to mop up all areas of a possible electorate that he can?
I think the speech was generally designed to activate and mobilize his base supporters, his core supporters. And I would point you to the extent to which he talked about illegal immigrants who are committing crimes in sanctuary cities blue states, states like California and New York. And he had in the audience a family member of somebody who was killed by an illegal immigrant. These are nativist appeals to his core constituency. And there were other gestures, too, that did the same. One might call them a troll. He invited Rush Limbaugh, who sadly is sick with cancer, but he brought him into the House gallery and had his wife, Melania Trump bestow upon Limbaugh the a Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor. And I think that was done in the presence of Democrats in the audience and watching at home on TV who may not like Rush Limbaugh, feel he's a conservative icon who has helped polarize this country. So, yes, I think you can point to messages in the speech last night where he talked about how he has brought down the African-American unemployment rate. But even that has to be looked at in a partisan campaign context. I think what the president's trying to do here is peel away some of the African-American support from the Democratic nominee in the 2020 presidential election, whoever he or she may be. And to the extent that he can do that in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Ohio in a narrow election, that could be that could make a huge difference. Mm.
But how do you do that in a speech when, as you say, on the other hand, you're giving Rush Limbaugh a Presidential Medal of Freedom because, I mean, mm-hmm. Rush Limbaugh was a birther. He has said a lot of racist things mm-hmm. on his show over the years. So mixed messages, to say the least.
Very much so, mixed messages. But I think also a partisan message. And I don't think you can overlook that. I think that this was, at bottom, an edgy, partisan, polarizing speech by a president who is determined to activate his political base. And I think that there was some language, I think, that sounded unifying. But dig into it, and I think what you'll see is a president who is very much trying to mobilize core supporters and use that rare primetime national stage to maximum effect.
Okay, let's turn to the other side for just a moment. Joe Biden today on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. Here he is criticizing former Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
I have great respect for Mayor Pete and the service of this nation. But I do believe it's a risk, to be just straight up with you, for this party to nominate someone who's never held an office higher than mayor of a town of 100,000 people in Indiana. I do believe it's a risk.
Okay, so here he is coming off a really poor showing in Iowa, if the final count proves the same as the initial 70% or so that's come in, and really, really bad showing in Iowa. And a recent poll from the Boston Globe shows he's not doing that great in New Hampshire. What happened to Biden?
Well, you know, I covered the 2016 Democratic presidential contest that came down to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. And for a long time, the question was Biden in or out? Was he going to do it? And it seemed like he was prepared to jump in. But ultimately, he sat out. And he was warned by some of the political operatives around Barack Obama that it could be deeply embarrassing for him if he entered that race, that he might find himself finishing third to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in Iowa if he ran in 2016. That his support really wasn't there. And that's certainly been his experience. He's run for president twice before, and it's not gone well. He's not done well in Iowa either. And I think that the fragility of his status as the front runner for much of this campaign in national polls has really been exposed. That Democrats, rank-and-file Democrats, young Democrats, might be looking for a fresher face than Joe Biden can offer at this point. And it's deeply frustrating to him. And I think you heard that in the clip that you just played, that a 38-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is defeated him soundly, a former two-term vice president who has decades of experience in the United States Senate and is on a first-name basis with many world leaders. I think that's what you're seeing.
Pete Nicholas from The Atlantic, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. Also in Trump's speech last night, a surprise reunion between a woman named Amy Williams and her husband who'd been serving in Afghanistan. First, the president thanked her for her family service. Her two young children were by her side. And then,
there is one more thing. Tonight, we have a very special surprise. I am thrilled to inform you that your husband is back from deployment. He is here with us tonight, and we couldn't keep him waiting any longer.
And then her husband came down the stairs and hugged his wife and children. Well, this kind of spectacle, according to Amy Bouchatz, is something she calls reunion porn. Bouchatz is the executive editor of military.com. That's a news and information site for members of the military and their families. And she's a military spouse herself, and she's on the line now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you were covering the State of the Union for your site, and then you saw that happen. What were you thinking?
Well, I immediately thought back to this bigger issue of surprise homecomings and how they really don't do too much of a service to military families. The problem is that when we see a surprise homecoming, it's very heartwarming. It's a great moment. But then for the American public, it ends there. And there's so much more to being a military family, to supporting military families, and to, being in the military, right, than that moment. And when we only show that, we don't give the American public a chance to really support military families. We give them a chance to check a box.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, the look on her face when that happened, it wasn't incredible. She wasn't like super happy. She looked shocked. She looked shell-shocked. I guess, what does it do to the wife in that moment of having such a charged emotional reunion broadcast so publicly?
It's obviously a lot of pressure, right? No yeah. military homecoming is the same. I can only imagine the stress of being there in that chamber with your two small children at 10 o'clock at night. You know, that's not a situation that I myself would really want to be in, just for starters, right? That's just sounds very, very stressful to me. I don't know her at all, and I haven't spoken with her. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that you can't look at a military family. Well, let's put it this way. If you've met one military family, you've met one military family, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't look at them and say, oh, we expect you and you should react this way or another way, right? Every situation's different. Every relationship's different. So while you really are looking to this person to give you, as the viewer, a sugary sweet moment that warms the heart and brings tears to your eyes, that's just not a reasonable expectation. And that's a lot of pressure on the spouse, right? To be in this limelight and, you know, having to react on the fly like that. I can't even imagine.
Well, what was it like for you when you welcomed your husband home from overseas? Obviously, it wasn't in front of millions of people on national television.
No, in fact, it was in a parking lot because we got his flight time wrong. And I was furiously trying to get my son out of the car. You know, I had this picture in my head, and I think this is a pretty common thing for military families. You have this picture in your head of what the perfect military homecoming looks like. Maybe involves the ideal outfit that you've spent months thinking about. There's, you know, maybe running, right, and jumping into each other's arms. And that's not how it goes, you know. For me, it was an incredibly emotional experience. Obviously, we had several months of a very, very stressful deployment where a lot of people did not come home. And it was a sigh of relief. It was a joyful moment, but it was also a very emotional moment. And it's not something that I would have wanted on public television. Now, I can't speak for every military family. And I can tell you that military.com's readers are really split on this. So there are plenty of people who are sort of with my personal opinion on this, that, you know, this isn't something that I would want. And there are lots of people who think that it's great.
And they think it's great because why? Because you're celebrating this reunion and it's a beautiful, joyous thing?
Right, exactly. Because it's a joyous thing, because it's a way to give the public a chance to participate in it. But, you know, I'm over here thinking, this really, it doesn't help us understand the military family experience beyond that one moment.
Mm-hmm. Because then once the cameras are off and you go back home, you have to deal with the fact that you led two separate lives for a long time.
Right. Military homecoming is very, very complicated, right? So imagine any time that your partner or spouse is gone for a long period of time, add the stress of military service on that, you know, that you're deployed, you're in danger. They never know if someone's going to come home safely. And what you have is a situation where you've really learned to function without each other, and now you are expected to fit each other back into your lives almost seamlessly. Really communicating through that is very important for military couples, but you might imagine any marriage has trouble communicating, right? So how does it work when one person's across the world for an extended period of time?
And that person has maybe undergone significant trauma.
Exactly. You know, you both have unique experiences. During my husband's deployment, I attended more memorial services than I can really count. For a while, it was once a week for multiple people. So I had that experience sitting several rows back in that chapel, watching widows and moms not, you know, go through this process of not being able to ever see their loved one again. And me wondering, how is it that I'm back here and not up front with them? You know, how did I luck out like that? And then downrange, my husband is dealing with a similar thing, right? He's literally picking up pieces of his buddies and wondering, why is it them, not him? Yeah. So when we come back together, we have to reconcile those experiences and how they've changed us. And that's the thing that you don't see during that sugary sweet moment.
Yeah. And have you been able to do that with your husband?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've been military family now for, well, I've been married 11 years. So we've learned over that time how to deal with that. We have a lot of resources as military families. I have a great community where I live who support me and who help me and who stand by me and work through communications. But that's not something that is just comes naturally, right? That's time and learning and becoming better people and using the resources that are available to us.
Well, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Amy Bouchatz. She's executive editor of military.com, and she's a military spouse. Coming up, the swinger defense, why sexual assault charges were dropped against an Orange County doctor and his girlfriend. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In what's being called a stunning reversal, Orange County DA Todd Spitzer says he plans to drop charges against a Newport Beach doctor and his girlfriend who had been accused of drugging and sexually assaulting at least half a dozen women.
There is not a single piece of evidence or video or photo that shows an unconscious or incapacitated woman being sexually assaulted. Not one.
Well, the case against Grant Robichaux and Sarissa Riley drew national and international attention when charges were filed 2 years ago by Spitzer's predecessor, Tony Roukakis. Now, those two men are blaming each other for the collapse of the case. Jason McGann has been covering this story for Los Angeles Magazine. Hi.
Hello.
Okay, so why did the DA, Todd Spitzer, decide to drop the charges? He made that announcement yesterday. Was it, as he said, simply because there was no video evidence?
Well, at issue is a trove of videos that were uncovered among the thousands of electronic files that investigators found on the couple's cell phones, taken from their iCloud accounts, online dating profiles, and so forth. It's not the videos themselves that are at issue as much as what's depicted in them. Roukakis, on the occasion of the couple's arrest, the videos show the couple in sexual encounters with women in various states of consciousness. He basically used that to warn that thousands of such videos were in evidence, suggested there could be as many as hundreds or even more than 1,000 victims of the couple. That was something that was carried widely in tabloid headlines and newspaper headlines around the country. And it's something that Spitzer took issue with at the time as a candidate for district attorney against Roukakis. And he said that basically it amounts to manufacturing the case and misstating the evidence in a way that misled the public.
Well, what about the women who came forward and said that they were sexually assaulted? Were they, I guess, not in those videos? Or was there other evidence?
Seven women came forward independently and accused Dr. Robichaux and five of them accused Sarissa Riley of sexual assault. None of those victims appeared in the videos that we're discussing.
Although they did say that they were attacked, despite the lack of video evidence.
Not only did they say they were attacked, but some of the women told police that they were filmed, that their alleged assaults were filmed on an iPhone.
For people who don't know the details of this, and the details are pretty sordid, how did this become such a big story? Who were these two people? Who are these two people, and what were they accused of?
Dr. Grant Robichaud was an orthopedic surgeon in Newport Beach. He had a successful practice. He was in his late 30s, and he was on a reality TV program on Bravo. He was once voted the most eligible bachelor of Orange County by Orange Coast magazine. So he was, successful, upstanding, seemingly member of the community. His longtime girlfriend was Sarissa Riley. They were living together at the time of their arrest in a fancy home on Balboa Peninsula, Newport Beach. What started happening was in 2016, two separate women came forward over the course of a few months, claiming that over the course of a night of socializing with the couple, they ended up being drugged and raped. A third woman came forward the following year, about 6 months after the second accusation. Initially, the Newport Beach Police Department ruled out the possibility of a crime. That was their evaluation of the circumstances at the time. But as the reports began to multiply, investigators led by the District Attorney's Office of Orange County started to connect dots and put together a case for, at the time, what they were calling a serial rapist, meaning Robichaud and Riley. In January of 2018, the authorities served a search warrant on Robichaud's home and uncovered a number of different drugs, including GHB, the drug that's known as a date rape drug. There were as many as 200 doses worth of GHB in a container in Robichaud's home at the time that the authorities executed that search warrant.
Wow. And did the current DA, did he tell the victims, the alleged victims, that he was dropping the charges?
It's my understanding that the victims were not consulted on the charges being dropped prior to the press conference.
Give us a little more of the backstory here between the two DAs, because as you say, that this figured in this political race, and the former DA was unseated, and the current DA used this as part of his successful campaign. Why was this a campaign point?
Well, to begin with, the race between Spitzer and Rakakis for District Attorney of Orange County was possibly the most bitterly contested race in Southern California in 2018. These men have been rivals, have disliked each other for about 10 years since Rakakis fired Spitzer from the DA's office, charging him with ethical violations and bullying of staff at the time. And Spitzer fired back with a two-hour press conference accusing Rakakis of corruption and basically went from there for about the past 10 years. The arrest of Dr. Robichaud and Sarissa Riley occurred a matter of weeks before the 2018 election for district attorney, and it very quickly became an issue in that race, with the challenger, Spitzer, accusing the incumbent, Rakakis, of using the case to bolster his flagging campaign for re-election.
So what does Rakakis say now?
Rakakis put out a statement yesterday which basically expressed his sympathies for the women who had the courage to come forward, he said. He regretted that the public does not have the chance to explore the truth during court hearings. He raised the suggestion that this may all be attributable to a political vendetta against him by the current DA.
Hmm. Well, so is there any indication that the current DA, Spitzer, will try to refile this case with different evidence or try in any way to get a conviction of these two?
His words yesterday were pretty much as strong as a DA's words can be in issuing reasoning for dismissing a case. And there's no indication at this point that his office plans to refile it.
And so the women who claimed they were sexually assaulted, what happens to them?
My understanding is that the victims are very concerned about this decision, particularly in beginning with the fact that they weren't consulted ahead of time. certainly the process of coming forward and identifying yourself to authorities as a sexual assault victim is not a pleasant one. And it's, I think the ordeal that they had passed through, I think, was done with the understanding that this case was at the very least going to go before a judge. And now the fact that it hasn't is a surprise to them. And I think given today's result, it also introduces the possibility that as a result of the dismissal, their accused rapist may actually be in a position to sue his alleged victims for defamation, among other things.
Oh, wow. Jason McGann, he's a reporter for Los Angeles Magazine, and we've been talking about the Orange County DA deciding to drop the charges against a Newport Beach doctor and his girlfriend, who both of them had been accused of drugging and sexually assaulting at least half a dozen women. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, the director of the Oscar-nominated Edge of Democracy is here.
The film came out from this scare, deep scare and trauma of seeing what I thought was the only thing certain in my country, which was democracy, slipping away.
That conversation next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Brazil only became a democracy in 1988.
When I was born, we couldn't vote for president. The military dictatorship was completing its 20th year. One of my first memories, I'm on top of my mother's shoulders, seeing a sea of people screaming. Brazilian democracy and I are almost the same age, and I thought that in our 30s, we would both be standing on solid ground.
That's Petra Costa, director of the Oscar-nominated documentary The Edge of Democracy. In her movie, she follows Brazil's first steps in embracing democracy, beginning with President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. His election in 2003. Lula, as he's known, was once considered the most popular politician on earth. Then he went to prison on corruption charges, charges he and his supporters say were trumped up by the right wing. Well, now the right wing is firmly in power. Jair Bolsonaro was elected president in 2018. He's an ultra-conservative former military officer who has praised the previous military dictatorship. Petra Costa joins me now, along with Joanna Natasagara, producer of Edge of Democracy. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Well, let's begin with you, Petra. This is a deeply personal movie for you. You narrate it, as we just heard, in the first person. And your parents were instrumental in bringing about this democracy, right? Tell us about your background.
I mean, they were a little grain of sand. But yes, I grew up believing that democracy was my birthright, guaranteed from a lifetime of their struggle, fighting against the military dictatorship in Brazil that tortured and killed many of their friends. And I never thought that in my lifetime I would see people asking for the return of the military dictatorship in Brazil, a far-right government in power that celebrates this dictatorship. And the film came out from this scare, deep scare and trauma of seeing what I thought was the only thing certain in my country, which was democracy, slipping away. And I wanted to document how that was happening to be able to understand and fight for regaining democracy while I'm still alive.
And you wanted to make it personal because...
Well, because I think we're all going through a political grief around the world, so many of us. My generation, we thought in the US, in the UK, in Brazil, that slowly but surely things would progress, right? More and more rights were being acquired. And when I understood that this was not just a phenomenon in Brazil, but when Brexit happened in the UK, when Trump was elected in the US, I sensed and read many people feeling a similar type of grief. And I was interested in that, in telling a relationship between a citizen and his or own democracy and what happens when that is in danger. Mm. So that's why I wanted to make it personal.
And Joanna, you saw the link too, sort of a step back kind of bird's eye view of what's going on worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first saw Petra's footage, I saw something I'd never seen in a political documentary before, which was, you know, a real behind the scenes look at the corridors of power in, you know, in one of the world's great countries, but done with such a cinematic eye. I've never seen a political documentary quite like that. But also what I saw was, you know, a country that I thought I knew something about. I thought I knew what was happening in the headlines, and actually I really didn't. And you know, what's happened in Brazil is real, you know, foreshadowing to what's been happening in Europe, mm-hmm. in my country, in the UK, and perhaps, you know, to some extent in the US as well.
But although a lot of people say, well, look, our democracy here in the United States and in the UK, it's a lot older. Mm-hmm. The rule of law is a lot stronger.
Well, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true, where you see the rule of law being eroded all over the place and, you know, and the will of corporations or perhaps politicians that don't want to play by the rules actually affecting our democracies. Then you have to ask, how fragile are they? Or in other words, you know, what do we need to do to protect them?
And Pedro, when you talk, when Joanna just mentioned corporations, and you also have a tie to that side of Brazil, the sort of the money-making side, the rich side of Brazil, right? Your grandparents made a lot of money in the construction business?
Yes. So my grandfather co-founded one of the major construction companies in Brazil. And I grew up quite critical of my grandparents because of my parents' upbringing. They broke off from the family in the late 60s. And there was this internal division in my family. And what car wash operation, which was this investigation that led to the impeachment of Dilma, Lula's imprisonment, and the election of Bolsonaro, what this investigation revealed was that for decades there had been a corrupt system where these construction companies were getting kickbacks from government contracts and with that funding electoral campaigns for all the politicians across the political spectrum.
Explain what Operation Car Wash was, because this is the scandal that brought down Lula and his successor, Dilma Rousseff. What was it?
Car Wash Operation was an investigation led by Judge Moro that for the first time managed to uncover this kickback system between construction companies, the major oil company in Brazil, Petrobras, and the government, as well as several political parties. It would work that every time the government would get a huge construction deal to build a stadium, to build a bridge, to build a road, part of that money, so let's say a stadium would cost $30 million. It was discovered that $10 million would go to a political party to fund their campaigns. Everyone was involved.
Including Lula?
Yes, that's where it becomes a little bit complex, but yes.
I mean, I think that the real point of this film is that the situation was very complex, mm-hmm. and it was just as complex for the Brazilian people to understand what was happening within their own country as it is for an international person to understand what's happening there. That's part of the reason that Petra made the film. You know, as a voter in any of these situations, how are you supposed to decide who's telling the truth if you can't even establish what the facts are? And that's something we're all struggling with, isn't it? So I think in the film, what you get is a very careful explanation of what happened in Car Wash and then what happened with Dilma and Lula and led to the rise of the far right. It's far too complex to explain on a radio show. You have to watch the film.
Right. Okay. So basically what happened was that this entire corruption scheme was made public. And from what I got from the film, it coincided with the economic misfortune of Brazil, then the worldwide recession, in fact, and that a lot of people lost money and they blamed the government and they said, oh, well, this is all part of the car wash thing, whether it was or not. And Dilma was caught up in that. Is that accurate?
Yes. the media and social media gave a sense that she was guilty for the entire car wash scheme, while actually she was allowing the investigation to take place and reveal this profoundly corrupt system.
But at the same time, the economy tumbled.
Exactly.
Brazilians lost a lot of money.
Exactly.
It was
And she was in part responsible for that as well, because she promised she would not cut on social programs. She would continue putting money into the economy. And as soon as she won, she betrayed her promises and did the opposite. So people felt betrayed by her. And that, I think, is the mistake she did.
Right. But she makes the point, look, you don't impeach a president if you don't like their policies. Mm-hmm.
Well, the key problem is, whilst Dilma and Lula strengthened the judiciary, which they should have done, the balance was out. So there was no check then on the judiciary, right? So then the judiciary became politicized and overran and overstretched and used their power in a way that was far too political, which is where Judge Morrow comes in. He was acting both as prosecutor and judge, which is inappropriate in most people's minds. So that, again, you're pointing at this delicate balance in democracy of the separation of powers, and it's not enough just to have a strong judiciary. If it's too strong against the other and against the other powers, then actually you're in trouble.
The scene at the close to the end where Lula is about to go to prison, he's exhausted his appeals, and he gives this speech to thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, it looked like. And many of them, you film or you show footage of them crying, and they're crying listening to his words. Can you just describe the hold he had on people? Or maybe he still does have a significant hold, because as I said in the intro, he was once considered the most popular politician on earth.
Yes, he left office after two terms with 87% approval rate. It was the highest approval rate that any president had ever had in Brazil. And he's still loved by many, not as much as he was when he left office. Now I think half the country still has a strong passion for Lula. And that moment was a moment where they were not just crying, they were fighting and holding with all their strength for him not to leave that building and give himself into prison. They wanted him to resist, and but he decided to trust the rule of law and give himself in, which I think tells us a lot about Lula. I think different from other leaders in Latin America, like Chavez or Evo, Lula has constantly abided by the rule of law. He did not want to run a third term, even though he left with 87% approval rate. He did not try to change the constitution like Chavez and Evo did. He says it in the film, like, we could have done a revolution, half the country would have died, half would stay in power. But no, we decided to play by the book and believe in democracy. And I think that's really inspiring for many people.
I think it's quite important to point out as well, he did that knowing that he would have probably won the next election, because he was going to run again, and he was a candidate, and by going to prison, he would remove himself from that election.
He was running against Bolsonaro.
Mm. Yeah. So it
and,
just
and
gives
the polls showed him ahead.
Exactly. So it gives a level of profundity to his decision for the country.
Yeah. And he's out of prison now.
He went out of prison in November because of a decision of the Supreme Court to abide by Brazil's constitution that allows for one to exhaust their appeals before they go to prison.
So is it possible that he'll run again?
It is possible. It depends on what the Supreme Court will decide regarding his current trials.
Well, how do you assess Brazil now? Do you think that there is broad support for Bolsonaro? If Lula ran again, could he beat him? Or do they want something else now?
Bolsonaro's support has declined considerably since he was elected. He has around 30% support, which is still considerable support. If the election were today, Bolsonaro might win. If Lula ran against Bolsonaro, it's more possible than that Lula would win rather than anyone else. But I think it would be wonderful if the Workers' Party gave space for more young people, young leaderships to arise. I think part of the crisis of democracy that we're seeing today is that so many progressive parties are stuck in the past and are losing their narratives to the far right that are being more invented, more original, and the left seems just stuck in a very old narrative. And the fact that you have Lula as the only candidate of the left that is strong today in Brazil is a testament to that.
Well, no, thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. That's Petra Costa and Joanna Natasagara. They are the director and producer of The Edge of Democracy, nominated for Best Documentary Feature at the upcoming Oscars. Coming up, a midlife crisis for women, why Gen X women can't sleep at night, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Just out of curiosity, why are you suddenly acting like a jealous girlfriend?
All right. We're just trying to pay bills here, okay? So, Troy, if you got any money.
Money? Oh, but what's money to an artist? To a philosopher. It's just a green-colored paper that floats in and out of his life like snow. It's nothing you actually have to, I don't know, work for, is it, Troy?
No, not if you have Daddy's little gas card.
You shut up.
A scene from the ultimate Gen X movie, one could say almost a documentary, Reality Bites. Well, that movie came out more than 25 years ago, and those formerly grungy, cynical slackers are now solidly middle-aged. According to a new book, many Gen X women are in a full-blown crisis. Why We Can't Sleep looks at why the women in this sandwich generation are struggling. It's published by Grove Atlantic. Its author, Ada Calhoun, joins me now. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, why are Gen X women having such a hard time?
Well, a lot of women are really crushed by a combination of working full-time stressful jobs, taking care of aging parents, taking care of little kids, while having their phones blowing up with breaking news alerts and demands from their bosses 24 hours a day, and going through perimenopause all at the same time. And that pile-on is new. In our mothers' and grandmothers' generations, women were probably empty nesters by now because the, you know, age you had a kid was in your early 20s. If you worked a job, it was probably 9 to 5. And most women were not trying to do both at the same moment in time as nearly all Gen Xers are.
You say that Gen Xers are uniquely stressed out also for other reasons, more like economic reasons. The economy for them was not as good as for their parents, and it probably won't be for their kids. But they're the first generation to really experience declining fortunes.
What I heard in a lot of the interviews I did, and I talked to a couple hundred women, was that there was a real contrast between how they thought this was all going to go and how it wound up going. So, you know, we were told you can be anything, even president, and, you know, the American dream is real, and every generation does better than the one before. And that has just not been true for us. Women only have like a 1 in 4 chance of out-earning our boomer fathers, for example. The reality of trying to do all the things all at once has really hit us hard, especially given that the economy has not cooperated.
And so you went around and interviewed a bunch of women, some of your friends or some you don't know. And can you give me an example of how a typical Gen X woman is dealing with this stress and or not dealing with it?
Yeah. So what I thought was so interesting is, like, we always hear about male midlife crises. There's all these movies and novels about them. And men, you know, get the flashy car, they have the affair, they act out in various ways. And all these women I was talking to and hearing about from these various experts I interviewed too, were just sneaking in any suffering they were experiencing around the edges of usually caregiving or working. So nobody around them knew that they were unhappy. Everybody thought, oh, you look like you're doing great, especially if you look at the social media. It just like looks like they're having it all and having it well and happy. So, you know, they might smoke cigarettes for the first time since they were teenagers, like out the window secretly. They might cry before they pick their kid up. They might go to a movie in the middle of the day just to be alone. It was very quiet. It wasn't inconveniencing anybody else, but I don't think that makes it less real.
So they're not going out to buy flashy Porsches.
No. In fact, like one woman I interviewed, she said like, oh, I bought a midlife crisis car. And all the women at the table were like, ooh, tell us all about it. And she was like, it's a Prius. It's secondhand. And it was like this very reasonable car. And everybody was like, that is not a midlife crisis car.
That is not a midlife crisis car.
The sensible Prius. No, does not count.
Well, so talk about the psychological effects, because you alluded to this earlier that Gen X women, and I'll include myself in this generation, I'll say we, were raised to believe that we could have it all, that we could have this incredible career, this incredible family, make money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And
yes.
Only to find out it's really not possible to do that.
Or, you know, or not without some costs, right? Like not without never sleeping or whatever it is. Something's got to give. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, one woman I talked to who studies generations, she said, like, this is a generation that judges itself on everything, like on so many different fronts. So like, you know, if it used to be you could judge yourself just on your job or just on your house or something like that, now it's like women are very critical of themselves in their work, in their home, in their looks, and, you know, everything. And that's just wearing a lot of people out. And a lot of the women who I interviewed would like sing that Anjali perfume ad to me. Like, you know, the bring home the bacon.
Fry it up in the pan. And never, never, never let you forget your romance. Never let you forget you're a man.
Very good. Yes, you
were. I memorized it.
The cohort, we all did. And that's the thing that I thought was so interesting was, you know, those messages, whether it was that or the sort of rhetoric around Title IX or whatever it was, really sunk down into our bones, I think. And then at this age, if you're not frying up the bacon that you made in the pan and still being sexy for your husband, like there is this sense of like, I'm doing something wrong. And I heard that again and again from women, this like nagging sensation that there was something amiss.
So what are they doing to fix this amissness?
You know, they're trying to do like self-care, right? Like that was something I heard over and over again. They were using some self-help book. They were doing the keto diet. They were doing yoga. They were taking Xanax. Like there was this patchwork of solutions here and there. And what I'm arguing in the book is that that it's much bigger than that. It's systemic. This is like, these are forces beyond our control in a lot of ways. And the first thing we can do, I think, is look at it and look at it as beyond just our failure to, you know, get the right job or take the right supplement or whatever it is that we think is going to solve this. This is a time of life that's hard for women pretty much always, but then for us trying to do so much with such high expectations, it can be debilitating.
How are women feeling about the sex part of it all? Just the romance and that part of their lives? Because what you're describing is lives of a lot of work and tedium. What about the fun kind of romantic side of their lives?
Well, so I feel like Gen X has always lacked a certain amount of pleasure. I think there's always been a lack of joy, sadly, for us. I think about when we became sexually active was right around the time of AIDS, either, you know, right before, right after. So we never had this illusion that free love was really something available to us. You know, drug epidemics were right around the time we were theoretically going to be experimenting with drugs. Mother Gets Sick Against Drunk Driving. There's this song from the 90s where the singer says that we were the cleanup crew for parties we were too young to attend. And I think that that's right. Mm-hmm. I think that we did not have the same kind of joyful, liberated teendom that our parents did.
Do you blame the boomers for all of this? Is it their fault?
No.
Come on, let's blame them. That's always fun to do that.
I mean, I do think, you know, that we get pitted against each other so much as women, like women who had kids, women who didn't have kids. Yeah. And I think the temptation is then to like not do that. And then we'll join forces and we'll pit ourselves against like boomer mothers. And the truth is, like, I think that a lot of the women I talked to, they wanted to do their mothers proud. And part of the disappointment in how things have turned out is that they didn't live their second wave mother's dreams enough. Like they had all these opportunities, and if they didn't make enough use of them, there was the sense that they let their mothers down. And one thing I've heard from people who've read the book, like boomer mothers, is that they had really good conversations, basically being like, this is not what I wanted for you. I didn't want you to be running yourself ragged and miserable. Like maybe some of the things we said, although they were well-intentioned, had this consequence of making you think you were supposed to do everything.
Do you feel that way?
So I did. I really did. And that was why I wrote this original story for Oprah.com that this book came out of and then did the book was like, nothing felt like enough. And definitely when it came to like money, I never felt safe. I never felt like you know, career-wise, anything was enough. And I felt like there was always this long to-do list that was never getting crossed off. And writing this book, doing this research, and talking to all these other women liberated me from that. And that's been a great gift.
Ada Calhoun, she's the author of the new book, Why We Can't Sleep. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for us here at Press Play today. I'm Madeline Brand. Don't forget, you can download our podcast and listen whenever you want, wherever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you get your podcasts.